When I found you in the wreckage of that ship, I considered leaving you. I was afraid you could bring trouble to us.
What do you think they want?
Don't look now, but here comes trouble, and it's not Kimmy. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Forever Fangirls podcast. I'm Sheila Amato, and along with my wife, the aforementioned troublemaker, we're your host, and we're glad you can join us.
I am not a troublemaker, but as you heard from the trailer, we are reviewing Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire.
Yes, this is currently streaming on Netflix since December 22nd of last year. But it was also released in theaters on December 15th, a week earlier, on a limited run. Our standard spoiler alert is in effect here, as we will be talking about specific plot points and themes, so if you have not seen Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, you will be spoiled.
So we're going to jump right into the movie facts, and forgive me for going a little faster than normal, because we have a lot of stuff to talk about in this episode. So the budget was $90 million. The Rotten Tomato ratings at the time of this recording was 21% for critics, 58% from the audience, and it holds a 5.6 stars on IMDb. So I'm not quite sure which ratings to go by. Mm-hmm. Zack Snyder directed the film. He also co-wrote the script with Kurt Johnstad from Atomic Blonde and Shay Hatton from John Wick. Part 2, The Scargiver, releases on Netflix April 19th of 2024.
Can't wait.
And then also just some trivia from IMDb. The story is influenced by Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, which is Zack Snyder's favorite film. Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, was also influenced by a Kurosawa film, specifically The Hidden Fortress. The royal print can be seen both on Jimmy's faceplate as well as Korra's gun. And the film's logo is a direct homage to the logo of the sci-fi and fantasy magazine Heavy Metal. So jumping into the synopsis from Netflix / IMDb, a combination of the two. When a peaceful settlement on the edge of a distant moon finds itself threatened by the armies of a tyrannical ruling force, Korra, a mysterious stranger living among the villagers, becomes their best hope for survival. Tasked with finding trained fighters who will unite with her in making an impossible stand against the Motherworld, Korra assembles a small band of warriors, outsiders, insurgents, peasants, and orphans of war from different worlds who share a common need for redemption and also revenge. As the shadow of an entire realm bears down on the unlikeliest of moons, a battle over the fate of the galaxy is waged, and in the process, a new army of heroes is formed.
So a bit more background on Korra. She was an elite soldier of the Motherworld, but she wasn't always this way. When she was 8, forces from the Motherworld invaded her planet and killed all of her family. She was spared by the general, Belisarius, and lived on their warship where she was trained to be a soldier. She became the deadliest, most accomplished soldier, and by the time she turned 18, was given her own unit to command. After winning an epic battle, she was commissioned to be the personal detail / watcher of the royal daughter, Princess Issa. Princess Issa was said to have healing powers and would bring about peace to the galaxy. When the king and the queen were assassinated, Belisarius made himself the ultimate ruler and wanted to crush a burgeoning rebellion against them. The movie opens with Korra, now a fugitive, hiding out for 2 years on a distant moon, living among farmers, tilling the land. So, that's a lot. Are you going to use that sound effect every single time now?
I really think it works.
Oh my goodness. Anyway, let's jump into the good, shall we?
Go for it.
Okay. I originally thought that this story was adapted from a book, but apparently it's a completely original Zack Snyder story. And I found that was just very interesting to me. You know, normally I'm not that into sci-fi films, but this one was very compelling. And I actually did not realize that 2 hours and 15 minutes had passed by when I was watching it. Mm-hmm. It was similar to when we saw the first Lord of the Rings film, The Fellowship of the Ring. When it ended, I was like, wait, what? No, it can't be.
Yeah, you were unhappy, I remember.
I was very unhappy. But yeah, I was really enthralled with this film.
I didn't know it was an original story. I thought it was based on like a graphic novel or something, but you mm-hmm. know. Very enthralling. I found it very intriguing, but for me, it was more of a reflection of like Mass Effect or Star Wars. I could see a lot of similarities in them. Obviously, now knowing the trivia tidbit, it makes sense. Very detailed. I understand why it has to be two parts. There's a lot going on that you got to kind of follow.
It's incredible world building.
I will give it that. There's amazing world building, describing different planets, different people. I think it could have been maybe even three parts or even a series of sorts, because there's so much there that could even be more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have to agree with you. I was rather surprised that knowing all those negative reviews, I remember pausing it going, wait a minute, we're already 90% of the way done.
Yeah, I have not read any of the reviews, so I am also shocked to see the low ratings.
Yeah, I had read them, some of them beforehand, so I did not go into this with high expectations, and I'm quite surprised.
Mm. Yeah, see, I like to enjoy the ride first, so.
But speaking of the world building, I have to say the visual effects were amazing. Considering this is Netflix, they didn't seem to put much in the way of special effects budget for, say, oh, I don't know, First Kill. So
you had to throw that in there.
I had to throw that in there. But it just seems like certain films on Netflix don't necessarily get that special effects budget, and then the film or series do kind of suffer for it.
Yeah,
I mean, I didn't feel that way here.
I wonder if it's because it's Zack Snyder, right?
Yeah.
Because the visual effects are incredible in this film. One example, the creature Benis, it's the half, or the griffin-like creature.
Mm-hmm.
The feathers of the creature was an iridescent, like black and forest green. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredible to just see how the colors change depending on, you know, the angle of the light hitting the feathers. And I thought that was incredible. You put a pin there?
I put a pin there, but not for the reason you think.
Okay. I'm going to move on to my next good then.
Go for it.
I thought that the characters in this story were very rich, and I was very invested in them, especially like Nemesis and Hermeta. Hermeta is the spider being. Nemesis had to kill her because Hermeta was holding hostage a human kid. The mother and child connection there between them, and then afterwards knowing that Nemesis lost her children in the war, that scene just made me cry.
Yes, I think Nemesis actually at the end, because she tells Hermeta that this is not the way, we can do it another way.
Mm-hmm. She was trying to plead with her.
Yeah, just let the kid go and we'll figure it out. We'll get justice for your children, because the whole point was the spider eggs no longer hatch because of the damage to the environment
pollution.
That mankind has brought, or the colony has brought.
Mm-hmm.
And when they end up, the battle is over and Hermeta is dead, people come in and they're like, oh, thank you so much. And she says, take no joy in this.
Yeah, there is no honor in it.
Yeah.
Because there was no winner there.
Yeah, they both lose because they were both struggling and both suffering. And one now has to take on the guilt of removing the other.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a very interesting little twist there, because normally you turn around and go, ha-ha, I've killed the beast, and this was not that.
Yeah. Korra, for me, was also a very interesting character because, yes, she is the lead, but it's a contrast of her story where now she's tilling the fields and nourishing people, whereas her former life, she was killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The beginning scene, even, she was smelling the earth and enjoying that smell. She was doing the hard work. I'm guessing it felt really good to her to be able to do that rather than to kill.
Well, it's her redemption.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed seeing that. Tarak, aside from his ridiculous abs.
You would bring that up.
Because I'm like, whoa, was that painted on? No, it's real. Okay. Of his planet, of his kind, he's the only royal left, and he's fighting for his freedom just like Benis, the griffin-like creature, and they helped each other be free of their captor, and I thought that was also a very beautiful scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Gunnar, he's trying to do the good thing. He's trying to make more money for the village. And because of that, he inadvertently ended up getting their leader killed because he said, no, we have grain. And the leader said, no, we don't.
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah. There's just so many rich characters in this story. That's why time didn't seem like it passed at all, because there's just so many things there.
And there's a lot of secondary characters that I think are going to be coming back in part two much more in the sense of screen time, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like Sam, they were going to hurt her. Mm-hmm. The soldiers that were left behind.
They were
going to
assault her, yes.
Cora ended up defending her and ended up removing all of the other soldiers, basically. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy is a robot who apparently when the king and queen were assassinated and the princess is alluded to being not around, in what capacity, we don't know.
Yeah.
But that they've not picked up arms anymore. And he did to defend to Sam. Mm-hmm. She was very kind to him. And he actually said, you remind me of the princess.
Yeah.
And then he fled because of what he did.
Yeah.
But that whole situation brought Cora out of hiding, so to speak. Mm-hmm. We find out that she was this warlord of sorts, but she's also hiding. So my really bad spoiler speculation, going back to my slip up, what's going to happen when they find out who she truly is? Because right now she's just some innocent farmer that happens to really know how to fight.
You know, at the end there, when she saved Sam, she basically revealed herself. She killed basically a whole...
But at the end on the horses... The general asks her, and she says no.
Oh, that's the thing that you're talking about. I thought you were talking about the villagers.
No, no, the villagers know she's some type of fighter, but nobody knows who she is. Mm. And if she was as popular and as well-known and as powerful, they would know the person who led the armies that wiped out some worlds.
Well, she told Gunnar a little bit of her backstory.
But again, when they ask her, she says no. Mm. Now, that could be because she's not that anymore, or it could be alluded to that this is going to be a problem going forward. Who knows?
Mm. Yeah. Here comes trouble.
I'm not trouble.
Anyway, going
into the themes, as I think it was Nemesis who said it, you know, revenge is not the only way to see justice. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was Tarak who actually said it was an amazing, and she said, don't celebrate this.
That was amazing. You know, how she killed.
It's such an important moment because when you're hurt on such a level that it like you can't sleep, all you do is think about it. Mm-hmm. You want to lash out and you want revenge. But the fact is sometimes the best revenge is living your best life.
Yeah. And I think the reason why this is so powerful is when Tarak said that was amazing, like Hameda is the big bad, right? Because she took the child, she should be killed. But the nuance here is that Nemesis says, hold up, that's not the whole story. There's a lot of gray. Like you keep telling me, there's a lot of gray. Mm-hmm. Nothing is really black and white.
No.
And so that makes it even more heart-wrenching. And that's why I was like, oh, I get teary-eyed just thinking about it now.
Isn't it Kevin Batchelder who said the villain is the hero of their own story?
Always. And that kind of brings us back to your point earlier that, you know, there's a lot of guilt there. And Nemesis having to kill Hermeda, she doesn't take any joy from it because she understands her pain. And again, Nemesis lost her own children. And so she knows what that pain is. And having to kill another mother who's suffering because of that is just, okay.
But you also have General Titus who lost all his men.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, he was in, I don't even remember which planet
was. He was drunk, though, and dirty.
Because he just had given up. There was no redemption for him.
Yeah.
He lost all of his men, and so he thought there was no point in him living. Until they came and said, well, what about revenge? Yep. And so that was what got his attention.
And truthfully, you have Gunnar feeling guilty over what happened and how, I think at one point he says 12,000 bushels and they're like, yeah, right, we're taking 10. He's like, but we're going to starve if you take 10,000 mm-hmm. bushels from us. I'm like, not our problem because they don't care.
Right.
So then he has the guilt that he basically not only got the leader killed, but now he's going to make everybody starve.
Yep.
And then Cora is feeling guilty because of all of those raids she did. She even says, I was a victim of them and then I became them. Mm-hmm. So that's guilt running for her. But going right into the next theme, it's you can't hide your true nature. You know, Kai being opportunistic or Noble being ruthless.
Yeah. I want to add something there with Cora, because Cora reminds me of Beatrice from Warrior Nun.
There's always more.
Yes, there is always more. And the reason why I say that is because Cora poured her heart and soul into being the best soldier that she could be, because it was almost like she was trying to hold off the sadness and the pain of losing her family and her home world. So she became the best of the best. She became the most feared assassin ever that they've seen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Sister Beatrice had many skills, but she was hiding part of herself because she didn't want to be hurt.
I didn't think that. I see it a little differently, but I can understand where you were coming to that conclusion.
How do you see it?
I see it as she was a young girl that had nothing and she was spared. I don't know if she could make the conscious effort to ignore what happened to her as a child. Like she even says, they broke me down to nothing and molded me in their own image. And then the only thing she had left was making her adopted father proud. And to make him proud was to be the most vicious, the best, et cetera, et cetera. That was my perspective.
So that's the psychology part of it.
It is. Another theme we found was, surprise, surprise, found family.
Yep.
It's hard for Cora to open up, but you know, once she did, the village and the people in it are now the ones she, quote, defends with her life. When the politics of expansion become too abstract and the way of the conquest was lost in the sheer savagery of combat.
I love that line.
It's a good line.
Yes, but she did. She replaced the lover that she had when she was in the army with the villagers. Once she finally accepted that, you know what, they took me in, they embraced me, they made me welcome, and now she was returning that favor by protecting them.
In the beginning, it's mentioned that there's never really been a place that's home because her home was destroyed. And at the end, now she's basically saying, yeah, I'm home.
Yeah.
You also have Jimmy the robot, who defends the village and its inhabitants, especially Sam, like we mentioned before. She had shown him kindness, and he told her all about the princess and the king and queen and how it was his job to protect them, and that when they were gone, they just stopped fighting.
Yeah, because after the king and queen were murdered, he really didn't have a purpose anymore. And their programming actually basically shut off once the royals were dead.
Well, I don't know if they shut off. It just they said it just didn't work anymore. They couldn't, because they were trained or programmed to only take orders from the king or the royal family. And without them around, they don't take orders from anybody else, if I remember correctly.
They didn't kill anymore. They just laid down their arms. They didn't fight in the war anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was such a big deal that Jimmy actually killed the commander who was trying to hurt Sam. And then I guess the final theme that I had here was that hope is a powerful force, just like love. Even Cora said, I don't want to give them hope because you're fighting against the big bad with 100 times more firepower than you do. You know, what is your chance of winning that? You know, nothing, almost nil.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do have hope and if you do have love, the forces are stronger and they can help someone endure an onslaught of tyranny and oppression.
Use the force, Cora.
Oops, wrong movie. Hang on.
But it is very true. So I'm just going to slip right into the bad then, unless you have anything else to say.
I do not.
Okay, so it is very true. I was reading some of the reviews where everybody's like, it's Star Wars, but not done as well. I can really see the comparison of Star Wars here. The influence is very similar. So yes, I can see a lot of similarities. However, in its defense, while some of the similarities are glaring, it is different enough where I'm okay with it. That being said, Snyder really, really, in my opinion, overdid those slow motion sequences. When they have an effect on a scene, like in the case of Noble, when Cora is fighting him towards the end and she kicks him off the platform and basically ends his life. For all intents and purposes, for those 30 minutes or 20 minutes.
He's dead.
He did. That slow motion of her kicking him and then him slowly tumbling backwards, because it's the culmination of all that emotion, of everything that had occurred, the entire fight scene, all these people had perished and whatnot, that made sense. Mm-hmm. When all of a sudden she's in a battle sequence and she's just running along a field, not necessary. When she was behind the rock and the lasers, you know, the bullets were flying past her, totally could understand it. When Tarak, I think his name was, when he's running and he goes to jump on the back of the griffin mm-hmm. from the ledge, unnecessary. It was so overdone that when we got to a point where it would add to the emotion, it actually was like, oh, okay, we're doing another slow motion shot. It was kind of that. And I understand what he wanted to do, but it became redundant to the point of where it didn't have the same effect anymore. And part of me wonders if we trimmed some of that, if we trimmed some of these wide open shots for establishing and everything else, we might have been able to get, again, I don't mind the runtime, but we might have been able to get
a little bit more
development on the characters, which I think were slightly missing.
Well, I guess it's his signature thing in the movies, huh?
Maybe. I mean, the rumor is there's a director's cut coming out sometime in 2024 of this one. So maybe we get more character development there. So I think that might have been my biggest gripe.
Okay. For me, at the start of the big battle scene, right towards the end of the movie, just to set it up a little bit, all of the main warriors, right, that Korra brought together.
Recruited.
They were held in these vice grip type things where you can have a gun basically put to the back of your head.
It's like a bolt gun that severs your spine.
And then you die, right? So my question there is, the only one who's not in this thing is the farmer. Gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, assuming that that's true and he hasn't been off world ever, how in the world did he know how to unlock someone from that vice grip?
And from my understanding, is there a distant moon, so they really haven't come across the mother world. Although he does sell grain to rebels.
Right. And they did see, you know, the owner of the inn towards the beginning of the movie be in one of these vice grips. But just because I see something like that doesn't mean that I know how to operate it.
There wasn't a direct connection.
Yes.
So I understand that because unless there's something we're missing, and in part two, we find out more about him.
Yeah.
But I get your point.
Because I'm like,
he
wait
saves
a minute.
Everybody, and then he knows exactly where to shoot.
Yeah.
To unlock everything.
That's why I'm like, wait a minute.
That falls very far outside the realm of disbelief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
That was my bad. Do you have any more bad?
I do have one more bad because I do need to go back to my...
Oh, okay.
So Tarak is riding the griffin. Literally, I looked at you at certain points and I was like, he would be on the ground or dead the way the griffin slammed him into the rock.
Yeah. Or really like torn up.
No, not even torn up. He would be missing an arm at the speed at which he was thrown from the griffin and then slammed into massive mountain.
Mm.
I get they were trying to break it like a horse,
mm-hmm.
but no. That fell outside the realm of disbelief for me. I couldn't.
Well, maybe his legs weren't like far enough.
There Look, would be I'm no trying. Legs left.
I'm trying.
It was like you with the how did he unlock it? It was just, is he superhuman? Is he Wolverine that I don't know about? And he heals like quickly? Does he have steel for skin? I don't know. But none of it is mentioned because a little bit of development was missing for a slow motion shot where he jumped off the ledge and landed on the griffin.
So I have an answer.
You have an answer? Mm-hmm. What's your answer?
He has awesome abs. Oh, come on. Come on.
Moving on to the cute.
All right. We kind of mentioned this before, but when Sam was sitting by the edge of the brook next to Jimmy, when Jimmy was telling her the story, you know, she made him a crown of flowers and she touched the robot's face, Jimmy's face.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jimmy actually blushed. I was like, oh, he blushed.
That was cute.
Wasn't that cute? It was so great. I love that scene.
Mm-hmm. Any other cute? Because I don't really have a cute.
Oh, Korra. Every time she called Titus General, he just kept saying, don't call me General. And it kind of reminded me of like Gladiator. Because, you know, the actor was in Gladiator. So
yeah,
it's just like, oh, okay.
I just have I'm really awesome because I actually said to you in the first 30 seconds, wow, that sounds like Anthony Hopkins. I think that's him. And you went, he's not in this.
I stand corrected. I said that I was wrong.
Kimmy Cat is awesome.
Oh, my goodness.
I am really cool when I'm part of a team. I am really
awesome.
She's
a troublemaker.
Nope.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, any other cute?
Nope.
Okay. So I guess that is our discussion of Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire. Now it's time for our Forever Fangirls rating. Drum roll, please. We rate Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, 3.5 stars. And this is a blended rating.
The flop or not is going to be weird in this section because it's not really a flop or not since it's on streaming, mm-hmm. I guess. However, according to ScreenRant.com, Rebel Moon Part 1 was the second most watched streaming movie for the week of December 18th through the 24th of 2023 with 966 million viewership minutes.
Wow.
Considering it was only released on December 22nd, that could be considered rather impressive. Leave the World Behind was the number one spot with 983 million viewership minutes. But if you listen to our podcast, you know what we thought of that one.
Mm-hmm.
But that film lost 50% of its numbers from the previous week. So it might be really anyone's guess on what Netflix considers a good film or not, or a flop or a success. We mentioned review percentages, you know, take them for what they are. Part two is coming out regardless. So we'll see what happens after that launch. I know you mentioned that there's more that yes. could be done.
Yeah. In early December 2023, Screen Rant actually had an article that indicated Rebel Moon 3 was greenlit.
Oh, it was?
It was greenlit, but it won't be available until 2026. So basically, part one and part two are like one chunk, and then Rebel Moon 3 is like the second chunk.
For 2026?
I guess so.
That's a long time to wait.
I know.
Wow, that's cruel.
Yes. So...
well, let's hope that comes to fruition. So, because I'm assuming then that this is going to end on an area or a part where we will feel satisfied. Like, I did good, slight good here. I did appreciate the fact that at the end of part one, it did feel like a satisfactory conclusion. There was a very big battle scene. There was a happy conclusion towards the end, but you knew there was more coming.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully two does the same.
Yeah.
Look, I have to admit, I was extraordinarily hesitant to see this film.
Really?
After reading the negative reviews.
You were the one yeah. who told me we have to see this, we have to see this, we have to
and
see
I
this.
And I said we had to see it in December. And then I took it off our schedule. And then I said, all right, you know what? Part two is coming out in April. We might as well go ahead and see part one because I didn't want to cover part two without seeing the first half.
Okay.
You know, but truthfully, I'm glad I was hesitant and I'm glad I waited because, I don't think I would have waited, done well with that long gap between.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of think this is one of those films that you have to see for yourself without the influence of others. And that includes us.
Mm-mm.
While I love that everyone tunes in and does listen to our opinions, that's just all they are. They're our opinions. So this to me is a film where I think you really need to sit down, watch it, and allow yourself to make your own conclusion. So I'm going to really keep my summary short here. For me, there are moments of emotional turmoil and moments that left me wanting. And overall, the film reminds me of Mass Effect 2. And if anybody plays video games, Mass Effect 2 is an amazing game where you fly around the galaxy recruiting all those needed to save the world from an invading force called the Reapers. My only hope is that Part 2 does not end like Mass Effect 3. If it does, it will go out with a whimper and not with a bang.
You know, you said you're my only hope, and I'm like, oh, Princess Leia.
I didn't say you're my only hope. I said my only hope.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was.
I had this Star big Wars. Thing with the, it's not, it's go as a whimper, not a bang. And you said it's your only hope. Wow. Thought I had some great emphasis there.
No, you do. You do. You did.
I do? I did?
Yes.
What? Which one is it, woman? You're confusing
you
me.
You do. You do. You always do. Sorry. So I rated this film a 4 because it kept me engaged the whole way through. Yes, there were some spots where the movie was slow, but it was necessary to help establish the foundation of the story. And it was clear to me how Korra really had to go to different areas and different planets even to find, you know, the people who could help her, her allies, if you will, for the rebellion. Korra defeated Noble on the platform and I cheered, which quickly turned to distress knowing that he was revived and he had to be defeated again. But at the very end, I really did enjoy this film, and I want to watch it again before part two comes out to see if there are any little things that I missed, because there's a lot in this movie, and I'm sure that there's a lot that I didn't see the first time. Aside from that, I also want to be prepared for when part two comes out. I can't say enough about this film.
Yeah, and you kind of want to know if the princess is just missing or deceased or...
Yes,
hiding.
Because there's so much like confusion about that. That's like a cliffhanger.
Is it though? I mean, it's alluded to.
No.
Right.
It's like, is this Anastasia? Is she alive? Is she dead? Is she alive? She could be alive.
The Princess Anastasia, who will let us find you and my friends part of our history.
Really? Really?
Well,
you're doing that now?
The movie. Anastasia the movie. Great cartoon animation movie.
It was also the Broadway show. I was actually thinking about the Broadway show.
Yes, well, the Broadway show came after and was not as good.
Just because it didn't have Bartok.
Was not as good.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway.
Anyway, on that note, that is going to be our show for today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in to our review of Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire. If you'd like to reach out to us here at Forever Fangirls Podcast, we have several ways you can do that. You can go to our website at foreverfangirls.com, find links to our Discord, social media, a contact form, and easy access to subscriptions and past episodes. Also, don't forget to leave us a review. It helps us out tremendously.
And until next time, stay safe, be kind, and remember, after he betrayed Korra, Kai said, "Never set foot on the wrong side of history." What he didn't count on was that Korra had the strength and loyalty of her found family behind her. She stood up for what was right. She fought for the right to be free, to choose her destiny.